You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the Wisconsin bands and artists who will be showcased at the South by Southwest Music Festival starting today. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Candidates vying for House Speaker Paul Ryan's seat were arrested earlier this week at a protest. The European Union is threatening to put new tariffs on some iconic Wisconsin products, and a Nina couple says they were scammed after investing in a retail franchise. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. Is it Friday already? Are we sure?
It's Friday, and we're getting ready to turn our clocks forward this weekend, Rob. You have that on your calendar?
All right. I'm on it. Okay. No, but you know what? You're right.
Spring forward. Well, now, earlier, let's start in Racine, Rob. Earlier this week, Kathy Myers and Randy Bryce, these are the two Democratic challengers. They're in a primary looking to run against Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan. They were arrested at a protest in Racine. What was the demonstration about, first of all?
So they were part of a protest outside the office of House Speaker Paul Ryan to protest congressional inaction on the DREAM Act, which is the policy by which the idea is immigrants who came to the United States as children and who meet a bunch of requirements would not be deported and could eventually become citizens. So Congress has not passed or taken up the DREAM Act, and so this is a protest against that.
And what led to the arrests of, among others, these two congressional candidates?
Sure. Well, I mean, they were intentionally being arrested. This was a sit-in. Randy Bryce, as a communications person, people with the Myers campaign, they considered this a form of civil disobedience and a way of calling attention to this issue that they think is important.
And they, Bryce and Myers, have been released from custody. What do you think these arrests do for this ongoing campaign?
Well, I mean, part of running a campaign, any campaign, is getting attention, right? So to the extent that it generates news coverage and discussions like the one we're having, I think that it's it is serving its purpose as a campaign issue. There is the issue of the DREAM Act the policy that under the Obama administration was known as DACA of not deporting these individuals is really a motivating issue among the Democratic base for certain. And that's why these two candidates, State Representative Jocasta Zamarripa and some others, were getting involved in this to sort of show solidarity with the activists on this issue.
Have we seen much in the way of reaction from the events this week?
Well, if you're somebody who opposes the DREAM Act, this is a stunt, right? I mean, maybe it's a stunt even if you're somebody who favors the DREAM Act. But I mean, the point here, and their point really, is to tie Paul Ryan to this. I mean, the DREAM Act is something that Donald Trump, President Trump, has said he supported, and at various times there's been a lot of conversation about a bipartisan deal that could allow this bill to pass. And then it's been scuttled by the Trump administration at various sort of key moments. But the thing to understand is that as Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan could bring this to a vote any time. And so that's sort of the point that they're making, is that Ryan does have the ability to move this issue forward, and he hasn't done it.
Another national story with echoes here in Wisconsin, Rob. President Trump signed an order to put tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. He's excluding at least temporarily Canada and Mexico now in some of the latest news. The European Union, though, is talking about retaliation, and some Wisconsin products could be on the list. What kind of products could be affected?
Right. Well, the first, among the first products announced were Harley-Davidson's, obviously a major Wisconsin employer. And then on Wednesday, a trade commissioner with the European Union issued some other products that are under consideration for new tariffs, sort of retaliatory tariffs, including peanut butter, but also cranberries, which is a large Wisconsin industry.
Right. If you talk about Wisconsin products after you hit the cheese and beer, I think Harley Davidsons are probably next, and cranberries are going to be in the top 5 or 10 list anybody comes up with. Let's dig into Harley Davidson a little more. I understand foreign markets are becoming more important for them. So what's happening in the U.S. that can make export tariffs hurt them even more?
Right. Well, Harley Davidson is, for one thing, uses steel to produce its products, so potentially is among the industries that could lose out in the Trump administration tariffs if steel becomes more expensive. But more importantly, much more importantly, is Harley Davidson is a beleaguered company. There are fewer people buying Harley Davidson motorcycles. By the year, they've been in decline. They've closed some large plants in Wisconsin and around the globe. A very large part, and the major part of their business that is increasing, is in Asia. So they require that market, the Chinese market, for their sort of overall outlook. So yes, this that is less the case about the EU, by the way. But this is sort of the whole discussion about these tariffs and potential trade wars. It's that any individual action, the actions taken by the Trump administration or these retaliations by the EU, you can sort of maybe the impact is not that great. The issue is that you get into this dynamic where now China is going to react and retaliate, and then the U.S. has to retaliate to the retaliation. And at some point, the risk, economists say, is that it's a drag not just on these individual industries or companies, but on the economies as a whole.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin about some of the top state news of the week. Before we leave tariffs, Rob, cranberries, we are a key global cranberry producer. We hear stories in some years that there's a glut. Farmers are looking for global markets. How big a worry is this if there are retaliatory tariffs?
Yeah, no, cranberries are massive in Wisconsin. The U.S. ships more than 95 million pounds of cranberries per year just to Europe. That represents nearly 40% of what U.S. farmers grow. So the export market for cranberries, and also this is true for an awful lot of farmers. Exports are a huge, a necessary market. I read this in the story, and I loved it, or it surprised me that in some past years, Wisconsin alone has accounted for more than half the world's supply of cranberries. So that is a big supply.
And finally, Rob, a story out of Neenah, it's getting a lot of attention. A husband and wife team invested in an outlet store franchise. Now they're suing the owner of the company, saying they were scammed. Set this up for us.
This story is absolutely wild, out of Appleton, from our reporter Maureen Wallenfang. So the store is called a Club Store Outlet, and the idea is that they sell overstock supplies, furniture, sort of, used stuff that's not in perfect condition, but they sell it cheaply. And this couple, who had sold a dry cleaning business and were nearing retirement, they say that they paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to open a franchise of this club store outlet, and what they got was actual garbage, not saleable merchandise at all.
Yeah, let's give a listen. Bruce and Cindy Schooley talking about what they received from this franchise.
The first four loads that they were supposed to set up for us were high-priced garbage.
Used trash cans that literally came in with trash in them. Used air conditioners that people have returned with rust and dirt in them. Use electrical equipment, speakers, things like that, where the power cords themselves were cut off.
And suits of armor, too, I think I read. So what happened next, Rob?
So all this stuff is in litigation. I mean, it's important to be a bit cautious.
Mm-hmm. Alleged.
These are this couple's claims that's going to be heard in court. Our reporter did talk with the franchise owner, a guy from South Carolina named Tap Palmer. His claim is that, maybe they got some bad stuff, but that's just how it goes. You sort of throw away the stuff you can't sell, and you sell the rest of the shipment. So that's his side of it, is that their claims are overstated. But what they're saying is that he is not running a legitimate business. They're saying that his real business is to sort of bilk people into paying these giant franchise fees, and then you know, he never intends to make to allow, you know, help them or allow them to run an actual store.
So we'll see what comes out of that in the courts. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us to check in on some of the top news from around the state this week. The South by Southwest Music Festival kicked off today in Austin, Texas. This year, our state will have a strong contingent of artists heading south to showcase their music and hobnob with music industry movers and shakers. Justin Barney is making the trip. He's music director at Radio Milwaukee. I talked to him earlier this week. Justin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I think we've all heard of South by Southwest, but it seems like it's this big thing that I'm not entirely clear what all goes on there. Can you give us the brief description of South by Southwest?
Yes. South by Southwest isn't exactly a music festival. At the heart, it's a music and film and tech conference. It's kind of a place where all these industry people go to discover in music, new bands, in film, discover new films, and in tech to discover the latest in tech.
And it started as this thing, what, 30-some years ago, and it's gotten huge, right?
Yeah, it started in 1987 as just this little conference slash music festival in Austin. The people that were setting it up expected like 1,500 people, and 7,000 showed up. So immediately it was a national hit. And, you know, by the year 2014, there were 2,000 bands playing at South By.
And as I understand it, there's like official South by Southwest stuff. There's sanctioned events. Uh-huh. There's also like the off-Broadway part of it where there's tons of other stuff going on in the area at the same time. Is that right?
There are bands playing in the street. There are bands playing in alleys. Most bands play like 14 sets. There are bands that break up at South by because they are just going through too much. It's a wild time.
Now, what's it like to go there and I guess you got to be paralyzed by choice, right? There's so much you could do and you can't see it all.
Oh, it's overwhelming. There's no way that you could possibly see it all. There is like the conference where a lot of the stuff happens. If you have, there's levels of badges, and if you do what you can in there, and then there's like Sixth Street, which is the Wild West. And I mean, there's like all kinds of things to see and experience. You can try to plan as much of it as you want, but a lot of it is just, it's just going to happen to you.
Now, for me, I feel like, yay, this would be fun for a while. And then, I don't know, a day into it or so, I'd be overwhelmed and just want to curl up in a fetal ball in my hotel room or wherever I've managed to find a place to stay.
Most industry people hate it. A lot of people go in dreading it. I've talked to a lot of my friends and other people in record labels and people in bands, and it seems to be this thing that's kind of unavoidable. There's a lot of people that don't want to go but feel like they have to, and there are parts of it that are super exciting, but then there are parts where it's, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning and you've seen 14 shows, you've been on your feet for 20 hours, and you just want to go to bed or get off your feet or do something else.
We are talking about the South by Southwest Music and Other Stuff Festival with Justin Barney from Radio Milwaukee. And Justin, I know you are trying to keep track of Wisconsin artists playing at South by Southwest. Does Wisconsin usually have a strong presence at the festival?
Wisconsin always has a strong presence. You have to be it officially or non-officially. I think in years past, there's been more non-official Wisconsin showcases than official. And this year, Milwaukee and Wisconsin are getting on the map. Webster X has a showcase with NPR. Field Report will be in playing at the actual conference, as will Juicebox and Dramatic Lovers. It's going to be a very productive and official year for Wisconsin, which is super exciting that we're finally getting in the door and booked on official stages.
Let's visit some of those bands now. You mentioned Webster X from Milwaukee. Talk about them and their presence at South by Southwest.
We are so excited for Webster X because he's going to be playing on an official NPR showcase. And that's part of Slingshot. Webster X is an official Slingshot artist. If you're not familiar with Slingshot, it's this initiative through NPR where they're using the power of a couple radio stations to essentially slingshot some artists that are not as well known into more notoriety. And a couple months ago, they came to us and asked us who they should nominate for the Slingshot series. And we said, you got to go with Webster X. He is electricity with a microphone on the stage. He is so fun and exciting to see. And we're excited that he has become part of Slingshot. And he's going to be performing officially for NPR. And we could not be more excited for that, for the state and for him.
Let's give a listen to Webster X and Everfeel. So Justin, this NPR Slingshot, I mean, is NPR the road to music stardom?
NPR, I definitely think that it can be in this age where everything is so stratified and it's kind of all over the place. NPR is a consistent and reliable music curators. They're fantastic gatekeepers, and I think that if I discover a lot of bands personally from NPR, and I think that a lot of other people do too. So we're glad that Webster X is getting in there.
You also mentioned Juicebox. Let's start off with a listen to them, Freaking Out. They're not freaking out. The song title is Freaking Out.
Oh, they're freaking out, too.
Count it up so many times, I can't count. They try to pick my style, but yo, that's when I dip out. Mental states start to slip out, but I can't trip out. Jumping out the bed, then I ship out. 29, but I'm 30 in my mind's out. I'm fly, looking in the mirror like who am I? It's Juicebox in this look. I'm feeling lost, feeling strange, feeling thick up in the gutter.
Well, that's fun. Justin, tell us about Juicebox.
Juicebox is one of my favorite artists because he's kind of a madman. He is grew up in Mequon here, and he has been doing his thing on like the underground hip hop scene for like 12 years. He's just like a tall, scrawny white guy, and he has this way of performing that's unlike anything else. He's like totally an artist. Frame of mind, and everything that he does is totally uniquely him. He played our 10-year anniversary here. He did like a gorilla street performance in the middle of the street, and it was one of the most fantastic performances I have ever seen. He just has so much energy, and he carries the crowd. He is a wild, wild performer to see.
So don't just listen. Go see him live, you're saying?
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to Dramatic Lovers. This song is Make Believe.
This is real life, living in a real life world, talking about real things, knowing it's make believe. It was a choice I had to make. I'm giving you space, I'm floating in a big place.
So, Dramatic Lovers, tell us about them, Justin.
Dramatic Lovers are a kind of indie rock royalty here in Milwaukee. They're made up of former Milwaukee bands Decibully, The Promise Ring, and Maritime, who were all just darling bands in Milwaukee maybe like 10 years ago. And here they've reformed under Dramatic Lovers. And so it's great to hear and see this music from these musicians, which we have loved in Milwaukee for such a long time. And it's great to see that they'll be playing in Austin.
And then this band is familiar to Central Time listeners. Field Report has performed a couple times just a few feet from where I'm sitting now in our Buck studio. Here's their song. This is one of their newer ones, Never Look Back.
Mm-hmm. I'm all about the day when we cut it all off, where we throw it all away. Forgiveness does not excuse. It just prevents all of the others from destroying you. Never turn around and look back.
And Field Report officially playing at South by Southwest.
Officially playing, going to be in the convention center. Field Report started off playing in bands with Bon Iver and when they were in Eau Claire together, and he's done his own thing. He is living here in Milwaukee. He's going to be releasing his new album, Summertime Songs, on March 23rd, and it's just a fantastic album, all produced here in Milwaukee, and we are we love Field Report and his music, so thrilled to see him there.
And then a Madison band also going to South by Southwest. Tell us about Trophy Dad.
Trophy Dad are kind of like my dark horse, my little band that I love. They're college rock to the core. So if you like bands like Sandy Alex G, Soccer Mommy, Frankie Cosmos, they are darling, sweet, touching, personal, just really fantastic. And they're going to be playing more than one show in Austin. They're from Madison. They all went to school together there. Going to school there.
Here's a listen to one of their songs. I hope I pronounce it right. Louis Sachar.
That's about right.
Trophy Dad there. Justin, as you get ready for South by Southwest, are you carefully preparing with a map and a timetable and an app, or are you just going to get there and wing it?
Absolutely not. I am 100% winging it. I wish that I was the kind of person who could be that prepared, but I know it's just one of those things that happens to you. I'm going to see a whole bunch of, you know, my friends down there and bands. And I don't want to miss something that is just going to, like, pop out and be super cool. So I am winging it pretty hard.
Justin, thanks for joining us, and have a good trip.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Justin Barney, music director at Radio Milwaukee. We were looking at some of the Wisconsin artists who are headed down to Austin, Texas, for the South by Southwest Music Festival. It kicks off today. Coming up, the federal debt is set to increase at record levels. We look at the reasons behind the spike and possible consequences for the economy. Federal deficits have been a big issue in politics over the last decades really, and according to a new report, they're only getting bigger. The Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says the soaring federal deficits and record high national debt are due in part to recent tax and spending legislation passed by Congress. The report says we're looking at permanent trillion-dollar annual deficits by next year and a level of national debt we haven't seen since just after World War II. Stephen Fazzari joins us now. He's a professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, I just used two words, and I want to define them here a little bit, deficit versus debt. It's always a good starting point. Can you tell us what each of those mean?
Well, thanks for that question. That's really important. It's so often confused in these discussions.
By me, among others.
Okay, so the government deficit is the difference between government spending and government revenues in a particular year. So when they talk about a trillion-dollar deficit, the idea is the government's taking in $1 trillion less than it is spending, and so we'll have to borrow the difference. When you borrow, the debt goes up. The debt is the accumulation of those past deficits. So it depends on how you do that measurement. In these cases, there is this talk about the federal debt rising to something like 100% of GDP, which right now would be just below $20 trillion. So 20 times the amount of the deficit we're talking about. So these are such huge numbers, it's usually to throw them around, but they're very different in the concepts.
And the big question people have been throwing back and forth over a bunch of years now is, does it matter? Does it matter if we have really big annual deficits and this pretty big-sized debt?
And that's, of course, a controversial question. And economists come down on different sides of this issue. My own view is that it doesn't matter as much as people often claim. And part of the reason for that is that people tend to make an analogy between the federal government and their own household borrowing, but it's a very different kind of a thing. If we look back historically, there's been lots of concerns about government deficits. I started here at Washington University in 1982 in the Reagan years, and at the time the Democrats were criticizing President Reagan heavily for the big deficits he was running at the time. And at the end of the day, it didn't seem to really hurt the economy. In fact, the recovery in the later part of the Reagan administration was really very strong. We saw a lot of concern in the George W. Bush years about the tax cuts early in his presidency leading to rising deficits. And again, interest rates stayed pretty low. There was obviously lots of criticism of President Obama and the very, very large deficits we were running in the at the worst of the Great Recession. Interest rates, though, stayed at historic lows, and the economy is doing, by most measures, very, very well right now. We've had somewhat slower growth since 2008 than I would have liked, but still, most of the indicators are all in a very positive direction. So there's really not a lot of evidence that these deficits, sometimes these very large deficits, have really damaged the economy in a very significant way.
One school of economic thought is, okay, when the economy's bad, we're in tough times, a recession, a depression, run those deficits, balance things out, juice the economy up. But then when we recover, we try to get rid of those deficits, try to make it up. And the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says, hold on now. Yeah, we ran deficits in the recession, and now we're racking them up at a higher point in our recovery. Do you see that as a problem?
Yes, I broadly agree with that, with the perspective that you just shared. We certainly needed big deficits in the teeth of the worst recession since the 1930s. So back in 2008, 2009, 2010, despite all the criticism that was coming at that time, mostly from the Republican side of the aisle, I think we very much needed those deficits. I think you can make a good case they should have been even bigger. That said, as the economy recovers, the deficit will naturally get lower because as the economy recovers, there's more production, more income, and therefore more tax revenue. And also some of the emergency spending on things like unemployment insurance will go down. So the deficit naturally comes down, and it has. It came down quite significantly, even in the last part of the Obama administration. And now with the economy reasonably strong, I think you can make a good case that this is not such a good time for a big tax cut in particular. The recent increase in government spending is a little bit different because that's more kind of catching up with what had been held back by the politics of the budget before that. But, I think that I would be sympathetic to the idea that this is not the best time for a tax cut.
Talking to economist Stephen Fazzari from Washington University in St. Louis, looking at the annual deficit rising and the overall national debt on the rise and how much, if any, we should be worried about that. Stephen, let's look at that tax cut now. The idea is the hopeful idea for supporters of the tax cut is, yeah, it adds to the deficit directly. It's going to boost economic performance. That's supply side economics. That will generate more revenue for the government. Not a big hit on the deficit. Is that true?
Well, that's certainly the argument. Again, my assessment of this is somewhat different. It is a hit to the revenue of the government. I think that's pretty clear. I don't think this particular tax cut will do all that much for growth. I think it will be somewhat positive, but the effects are relatively small. As kind of a mainstream perspective, I just saw an analysis that came out of Harvard mentioned today in the press that suggested, well, maybe the economy might be 0.4, maybe a half a percent larger after 10 years, not very much. If that's the overall effect of these tax policies, then it's not going to get us back all that much revenue. I think in other situations, or also with policies that might be more stimulative, you could get more of an effect of the kind that the supporters of this tax cut talk about.
You've written about different kinds of tax cuts in the past. Do you think that this particular tax cut could have been done in a way that maybe boosted the economy more?
Yes, I think it could have been. I think that still, even though we have a reasonably strong economy now, it would not be hurting. Would not hurt us at all to put more money back in the pockets of middle-class taxpayers. There's some effect there, but those effects are temporary. They're going to expire. Of course, they could be renewed, but that will even magnify the effect on the deficit. I think there was a reasonably good case for cutting the corporate tax rate. Even the Democrats broadly agree that the U.S. corporate tax rate was too high relative to the rest of the world. But we didn't have, you know, we could have offset that with other changes, closed loopholes and other things. To my mind, the biggest problem with this tax cut is its effects on inequality, that it really does benefit people at the upper end of the income distribution. And I don't think there's a lot of evidence that these so-called supply side effects, these kind of trickle-down policies, are likely to be all that effective. You know, the U.S. corporate sector was really rolling in cash before the tax cut, and now we're seeing that even though there are some bonuses being paid out, some kind of initial responses that get a lot of press attention, that looks like most of the money coming back into the corporate coffers is going to go to share buybacks and dividends, which go very disproportionately to the most wealthy people in our society.
Another concern about the debt is, okay, if the United States owes so much money, it's in effect borrowing so much money. I've seen people say, okay, that sucks the liquidity out of the economy. Money that's being lent to the United States government isn't being lent toward some sort of productive business purpose. Is there something to that?
I pretty strongly disagree with that view. You know, if the economy was running super, super hot, we might have some of that going on. And, you know, there is a sense that we're pretty close to full employment, although I think one can argue about that with lower labor force participation and fairly sluggish growth over the last 10 years. But in the kind of environment we are right now, I don't think you're seeing a lot of sense that there's not enough liquidity and not enough money in general to be lent out. You know, we know that banks are sitting on large amounts of reserves. If they want to make loans, they can make loans. I don't think that the government deficit is in this current environment strongly crowding out private spending. If that were the case, we'd see spiking interest rates. And interest rates have been up a bit recently, in some sense, in part because of the various stimulus packages we're talking about. But if you look at you know, almost any time in history, interest rates are still pretty low.
And I've seen people point to that, saying, "Okay, this last few years, interest rates have been so low, this is cheap money for the government to borrow."
Exactly.
But if interest rates start climbing over the next few years and we still have to borrow, you know, if we're running a $1 trillion deficit each year, we're borrowing against that and the rates are higher, the interest fees really do start to rack up.
Well, I think they're, you know, in general, if we borrow more, we'll pay more interest. If interest rates higher, of course, we'll pay this. But I think these effects move very slowly, and we're not facing any kind of imminent disaster. And there's also a little bit of a subtle point here, which is, well, what would drive interest rates higher? What would drive interest rates higher primarily is if we had a very strong economy, we start pushing up against capacity constraints of businesses to produce, we're at full employment, it's harder to find workers. If the economy is growing strongly, well, it's also going to be generating more tax revenue, which will tend to, if interest rates are higher, we'll tend to see more tax revenue, and that will bring the deficits down. If things are weaker and we have less of that tax revenue, then we'll probably see interest rates be much more moderate. So while the basic idea, if we have more debt, we'll pay more interest, is correct, the amount of interest the U.S. government is paying is affordable and probably for the foreseeable future will continue to be affordable. So while no one wants deficits, no one wants the debt to be any larger than it is, I don't think we're looking at any big crisis, at least over the next few years.
The federal deficit is expected to hit a little over $1 trillion next year, according to a new report. We're talking about that with Steve Fazzari. He's professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the growing annual federal budget deficit, the growing overall federal debt? What would you like to see done about it, if so? Or is that not a top priority, you think, right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about the federal deficit with Steve Fazzari. He's a professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the annual federal deficit getting bigger, the debt growing? What, if anything, do you think should be done about it? Are you worried about the national debt or the possible solutions to it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And on that point, Steve, there's been some talk of the need for changes, reforms to the so-called entitlement program, Social Security, Medicaid. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House from Wisconsin, has been talking about this. Do you see that as a likely step to try to bring down the deficit?
In the short term, almost certainly not. These programs are very popular. I think many people consider them very, very important. If anything, especially on the healthcare side, we're probably likely to see rising spending, not falling spending. And of course, with the retirement of the baby boom, Social Security costs are going to be going up. In the long run, and I'm talking about probably decades down the road, with these trends, eventually it's likely that we'll have to see either some benefit cuts or some tax increases. And the we'll have to talk about, or the country will have to decide which direction to go in that case. And my own understanding of things with the way healthcare is, I think we're likely to see more of a government role, at least in financing the healthcare, if not providing it, rather than less. And Social Security is a very good program in many respects, but not terribly generous compared to other countries. And so I don't really see that being cut, which would suggest that over a longer horizon, we'll probably see somewhat higher taxes to take care of these programs.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Stan is with us in Franklin. Stan, hi.
Hi, yes. We talked about, the money's coming in and you just mentioned about they would have to, is that money going to be earmarked for spending, or is that going to be earmarked, majority of it, or for the paying down of the debt? So the debt, does it really, when things get better, does that money that's coming in, does it pay down the debt significantly, or is the debt just what it is and we continue to spend for other things and the debt just doesn't go away? It just gets talked about.
Stan, thanks for calling. So, Steve, even if we do see more revenues in a recovering economy, does that actually end up going toward paying down the debt?
Well, probably not in a direct sense, probably not in the sense that Stan would think about it, that the U.S. government is not like a household. It hopefully goes on forever. And so we're very unlikely to ever really pay down the debt absent, really fast growth. There was some talk in the late 1990s when we had a really booming economy of the U.S. debt going away, but it was very quickly became clear that wasn't going to happen. Basically, the question isn't so much whether we're going to pay down the debt or not, but how fast is the debt growing relative to the size of the economy? In recent years, it's probably started debt relative to the size of the economy has stabilized after going up fairly dramatically in the Great Recession. And with these changes in fiscal policy, particularly the tax cut, we're likely to see that debt to GDP ratio, debt relative to the size of the economy, rising. If we get somewhat faster growth, that might stabilize a little more than people fear right now. So we're not likely to be paying off the national debt.
Thanks for the call, Stan, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the annual deficit and the overall federal debt with Steve Fazzari, professor of economics at Washington University. Steve, I mean, for a layperson, a non-economist like me, we look at these numbers, $1 trillion a year being added to the overall debt that's coming up anyway. Psychologically, that seems really big and unsustainable, and yet you don't seem too concerned by it. How do you talk someone down if they are looking at that and thinking, that's huge?
Well, let's think about what we talked earlier about some of the consequences and what the evidence is. Despite these concerns, there really hasn't been any kind of federal deficit disaster over the last several decades. But maybe a little bit different way of looking at it and say, well, what really is the cost to the taxpayer of this debt? And the answer is that we have to pay interest. The government pays interest on this debt. Well, let's just think about what those interest rates look like right now. The interest rate on the 10-year Treasury bond, which is a pretty long part of the government debt, higher interest rates than where most of the debt is financed, is running about 2.8 to 2.9% right now. But then we've got inflation about 2%. So every year, in a sense, the dollars are 2% cheaper. So what economists call the real interest rate, the difference between the actual rate you pay and the inflation, the erosion in the value of the dollars you're paying back, is less than 1%. Well, if we had a debt-to-GDP ratio of 100%, which we don't have yet, but some of these big deficits may get us there, we would still only be paying 1%, in a sense, in real interest rates of our total output as interest. Now, maybe interest rates are going to go up some. Actually, if I look back historically, I take a number probably closer to 1.5%. But it's still not this sense that it's fundamentally unsustainable or unaffordable. It is, of course, we'd be happier if we're paying 0.5% or 0.75% of the economy in interest rather than 1 or 1.5%. But it's not like we're about ready to go bankrupt in that, in some sense. So numbers like billions and trillions become, kind of hard to wrap your head around when you think about it. But the United States is a very, very big economy.
Let's talk about the politics of this a little, because it seems very common for, if I'm a member of the party that's not in power,
I'm really worried about the deficits and criticizing the other side for running them up. That when I come into power, well, I've got a lot of good reasons for having that deficit. I start to not worry about it so much anymore. Do you see that happening over time?
Absolutely. I've been around long enough. Actually, I have a Wisconsin connection. I graduated from J.I. Case High School in Racine in 1974.
Oh, no kidding.
So a shout-out to my graduating class if they're spending their Friday afternoons listening to intelligent talk on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And they are.
Very good. But, you know, in that sense, so I've been around for a while, and it's exactly as you describe it. You know, in my early years as a professor, when I was most conscious of these policy things were the Reagan years, and the Democrats were all over the president for running deficits. Again, Democrats hit George W. Bush pretty hard on those issues in the early 2000s. The Republicans hit the Obama administration extremely hard, as we well know. Part of the birth of the Tea Party was the result of that criticism for those deficits that we, in my view, needed in the Great Recession. And now you have, things are a little bit unusual in this sense. I don't really see the Democrats criticizing the deficit too much right now, although I could be corrected on that. But certainly the Republicans are much more relaxed about this rise in the deficit at a reasonably strong economic time than they were about the rise in the deficits during the Obama years. So the politics, clearly, people don't seem to have the too firm of an anchor in terms of their views about deficits when it comes to what they see as their political interests.
As we wrap up, Steve, do you worry about, you know, if people do get too concerned about the deficit and Congress and the White House try to fix it, the fix doing maybe more harm than good?
Yeah, a lot depends on how it's done. If you try to impose austerity at a time of a weak economy, I think the Europeans experienced this in the aftermath of the Great Recession. It's almost certainly counterproductive. You know, you weaken your economy, you increase unemployment, and you probably don't really improve your fiscal position. In the current environment, we could make some adjustments. In some ways, we could probably have some closing of various kinds of tax loopholes and changes in the tax system that wouldn't be terribly damaging in the current environment and would cut the deficit. I don't expect that to happen. In part because we're not going to see this type of severe crisis in the next few years that just says this is clearly not working. It's clearly unsustainable. So we're probably going to muddle through. If we get decent economic growth, it might not be as bad as it seems.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I enjoyed it, Rob. Thank you.
We've been talking to Steve Fazzari. He's a professor of economics at Washington University in St. Louis and a high school graduate from Racine, we found out. He joined us to talk about the growing annual federal deficit and the contribution it's making to the overall federal debt.